Right, I think we'll make a start. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the London School of Economics and Political Science. I'm Lynn Miles. I work for ARUP, a global consulting firm, and I'm a deputy director of the What Works Centre for Local Economic Growth. It's a great honour for me to welcome tonight Professor Henry Overman. Many of you will be aware that Henry's a professor of economic geography here at LSE, and he's the director of the What Works Centre for Local Economic Growth. The centre is a partnership between LSE, the Centre for Cities, and ARUP. I'm equally delighted to welcome back to LSE David Halpin, who's Chief Executive of the Behavioural Insights Team, and Alexandra Jones, Chief Executive of the Centre for Cities, which is the only think tank focused on understanding how and why economic growth and change takes place in Britain's cities. They produce research that helps cities improve their performance. This event is entitled Local Economic Growth: Do We Know or Care What Works? And it marks the second lecture in the 2017 series of LSE Works. LSE Works is a series of public lectures that began in 2011 that showcases some of the best research by LSE's academic departments and research centres in an accessible and public-facing manner. In each of the sessions, LSE academics present key research findings, and where appropriate, they demonstrate the implications of those studies for public policy. These are held every 2 years, and this is the second series of LSE Works. In 2017, LSE is delighted to continue the success of LSE Works with a fourth series of public lectures. The next lecture will be given by Professor Kenneth Benoit from LSE's Department of Methodology, entitled The Brexit Debate Through Social Media: Deliberative Discussion or Deliberate Dysfunction? And it will be held here in the Hong Kong Theatre on Wednesday, 25th of January 2017. Tonight, though, Professor Henry Overman discusses what we know about the effectiveness of different policies in driving local economic growth, and asks what role, if any, this evidence plays in formulating policy. For Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSEWorks. Please put your phones on silent, though, so as you don't disrupt the event. The event is being recorded this evening and hopefully will be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. After the lecture, there'll be a chance for you to put your questions to the panel, but for now, will you please join me in welcoming Professor Henry Overman to deliver his lecture.
Thank you. Thank you to so many of you for coming. Actually, I was struck while Lynn was saying that I think I gave the first ever LSE Works lecture 4 years ago, which also was my inaugural lecture. I'm much more relaxed, nervous, and older now than I was on that occasion. So let me talk to you a little bit about local economic growth. Do we know or care what works? Let me start with the challenge. And I don't want to spend too long on this. I think this, the background for the state of spatial disparities and the extent of them is fairly well known. But let me just give you something that gives you a feeling for the nature of the challenge that we face. So I thought that I would do that by just simply presenting some numbers here that show growth rates. Now, these are population growth rates. I think population growth rates of different places are a good way of thinking how well overall a place is doing, which is why I chose to focus on these here. And there are a few things here that I want to highlight to give you a feeling from the nature of the challenge. So the first thing to highlight is in the second row down, which is just how consistently well London has done in terms of population growth since about 1991. So you see, in the period 1991 to 2001, London really was the only major city seeing positive population growth. Now, you know, if I took this further back, you know, London wouldn't have been doing so brilliantly, but certainly by the early 1990s, it had already managed to turn itself around, seeing good population growth. And that population growth was reinforced, you know, pretty strongly in the 2000 periods. And that, of course, reflects, you know, just how strong growth is in London and the South East. And then here, the other places I put here were, actually, I did this slide a few years ago, and they were all Premier League football teams at the time that I picked them. You see that some of these places are not doing quite so well on this criteria, let alone population growth. So I picked Birmingham, Stoke, Manchester, Liverpool, Newcastle and Sunderland. And I picked them because they highlight just how appalling economic performance was in these cities during the 1990s. You see, just across the board, we basically had these cities essentially losing population. The other reason why I picked them is that some of these cities have experienced the turnaround in the 2000 to 2011 period, and it really, for some of them, it really is quite marked. So, you know, if you look at Manchester, I mean, Manchester was losing population during the 1990s and instead has turned around and seen quite consistent positive population growth since. But you also notice that neighbouring Liverpool, you know, is doing nowhere near as well in terms of turning itself around from that really quite difficult position. So we've got a situation where we've got London and the South East doing really very well consistently, and we've got patches of recovery across the rest of the country, right, where we see some cities doing really quite well relative to where they were 15, 20 years ago, but neighbouring cities really doing still struggling. So I want to talk this evening about how we respond to that challenge, and I thought I would do this in two parts. So the first part of the lecture talks about what works in the sense of what do we know about the economic forces that are driving these spatial disparities. And the second part of the lecture will focus really much more specifically on the policy response and what we know about policy effectiveness in responding to these disparities. So let me start with the big picture. And do we know or care what works in terms of the big picture, the economic drivers? So, you know, in the 30 or so minutes that I'm going to speak for, I'm not going to go in huge details. You know, any of you who are here lectured by me will know that these are ideas that we develop over a year and three or four different lecture series, so I can only give you a flavour for it. But here is what I think we know about what, you know, the big economic drivers that help explain those disparities. So the fundamental point to get here is that the market forces that determine the economic geography of any country, and I'm going to focus my comments on the UK here, tend to drive us toward profoundly uneven development. Okay? And it's against this background that we make policy decisions about what we're going to do to try and ameliorate these differences. So let's talk about those economic drivers, and I don't want to focus on all of them. I want to focus on establishing the really, really big picture, okay, and the big, most important drivers. So here is thing number one that has happened during that 20-year period for which I put up those figures just now. So what this slide tells is it ranks industries by how much they benefit from being in big cities and being spatially concentrated, okay? And I want you to note, it doesn't really matter how they're ranked here, apart from the ones at the top benefit least from being in big cities and spatially concentrated, and the ones at the bottom benefit most. Okay. And the really crucial thing to notice here is that manufacturing is an activity that, although historically it had a very strong urban bias, increasingly nowadays is something that you don't necessarily want to do in cities, in big cities, with all of the congestion, etc., that comes with it. It's something that increasingly we like to do on greenfield sites with easy access to motorway networks, basically away from urban sites. So you see that manufacturing as a whole doesn't benefit very much from these agglomeration economies. And you notice down towards the bottom here are a bunch of things that do. And those things are things like business and manufacturing consulting, finance and insurance. So one of the big things that has happened is that the structure of the UK economy has shifted away from manufacturing towards finance, insurance, real estate and other service activities that benefit a lot from being strongly spatially concentrated in big cities. And one of the fundamental consequences of this is that some places are going to do badly and other places are going to do well if they tend to get these industries. Okay? So one of the crucial parts of the story is that structural change. A second crucial part of the story is the kind of workers that are employed by those industries and where those workers are choosing to locate. So on this slide here, I've stolen stuff from Centre for Cities. Apologies, Alex, for not crediting you on the slide, but at least I've done it in person. On the proportion of the population with degree or higher qualifications. Okay, and you see, I mean, there's a whole mix of places here, but you see that these are places that we would generally think of as doing pretty well. Okay, Oxford, Cambridge, Edinburgh, Brighton, Aberdeen, London, York, Cardiff, Reading. Okay, so another crucial part of the story here is that we've seen this structural shift, And we've also seen that those industries tend to employ lots of highly skilled workers, and those highly skilled workers are very spatially concentrated. The average in the UK is about 25%. So some of these places have double the average in terms of their concentration of skilled workers. So these are two crucial drivers of spatial disparities. If you basically get particular kind of industries concentrating in particular locations, and then you get lots of skilled workers concentrating in particular locations, we're going to have some locations doing well, other locations doing badly. So where do those skilled people work? This is something that I pulled out from work that I did with Steve Gibbons and Panu Palpanon when he was based at the LSE. Along the bottom here, I have said, let's go to an area and let's see whether or not the workers in that area are high-skilled or low-skilled. So if you're on the right of this graph, you're an area which has lots of high-skilled workers. If you're on the left of this graph, you're an area which has lots of low-skilled workers. By the way, I usually try and disguise the ones that sit out to the left, but unfortunately there's not a lot I can do about Burnley here, which really sits a long way out on the left-hand side. On the y-axis, though, we've put how productive firms are in those places. So what wages are firms able to pay workers, independently of their underlying characteristics? And what you notice here is something that also helps explain these spatial disparities, which is that the highest skilled workers also tend to live in areas which are productive from the point of view of firms. Okay? So if you want to understand London's superior performance, there are two parts to it, one of which is that, yes, London is a productive environment in which firms can produce. The other part of the story is that London attracts large numbers of skilled workers. Not to get too technical, but the area productivity and the individual worker productivity, these things tend to be positively correlated. And it's this sorting of the most productive workers into the most productive places that, really drives up spatial disparities. Now, this picture is crucially important for when we start to think about what might work and whether we pay attention to the evidence, because it tells us that we've got two things going on here, one of which is stuff to do with how productive the area is, the other which is to do with how skilled the workers are who live there. Okay? And that will, come back to be a crucial thing as we go through. So the story of uneven development in the UK is technological change and globalisation, a shift towards services that benefit from being in big cities, and that being one factor that drives uneven development, and this being reinforced by two factors. The concentration of skilled workers in the most productive places, and something that I didn't illustrate with a figure, but which I will comment on, which is then a further reinforcing factor, that having skilled workers concentrated in and of itself can make the area more productive. So, some of London's advantage is this feedback loop from the fact that having large concentrations of high-skilled workers then feeds back into making the area even more productive than it would have been. All right? So you can see how all of these things are self-reinforcing and lead to very uneven development. Now, you might like to know which of these two factors are more important, the area thing, the differences in firm productivity between places, or the sorting of skilled workers. I mean, this will be crucial for thinking about which policy levers we should be trying to pull. All right? Should we be trying to do stuff on the skills? Should we be trying to do stuff on the area? So let me just show you here how I think about this. The top column here, titled Raw, basically says, let's just go and compare average wages, average area wages. And let's go to the poorest place in the country, which is somewhere rural and southwestern, I shan't name it, okay, in terms of average GDP, at least in terms of travel to work area. And let's go to the richest, which is London, I'm comfortable naming success. You see, the average wage disparity is 67%. Now, this sounds like a massive call to action, right? We must do something to get average wages in this area in the southwest, rural area of the southwest of England, up to London levels. But let's do that decomposition. Let's say, hold on. But we know that we've got a large concentration of skilled workers. So let's follow a skilled worker as they move from Cornwall to London. How much does their wage change? And we see that actually their wage only increases by about 16%. So 16% is the bit that is attributable to the area, to London and the functioning of the London economy. 67% is the very large number that comes about because we have a very large concentration of skilled workers in our capital city. So that's one way in which we need to be careful. People are far bigger drivers of area disparities than these underlying area differences in productivity. The other thing to be careful of here, by the way, is that it's always dangerous to compare the extremes of the distribution. It really does make no sense as a guide to policy to be thinking about productivity and wages in the deepest rural parts of the southwest, comparing them to productivity and wages in London and worrying about that gap. Far more sensible to do comparisons somewhere in the middle of the distribution. And there you notice that these disparities actually narrow pretty quickly anyhow, right? So even on the average wages, we have a 25% gap if you do the 90th percentile to the 10th percentile, and we have a 10% gap if you do the 75th percentile to the 25th. All right. Those gaps get even smaller once we condition out the fact that the city at the 10th percentile has a different skill composition to the city at the 90th percentile. All right. So it's crucially important, as we go through the rest of the talk, to keep these figures in the back of your head. A large part of what we're seeing in terms of uneven performance in the United Kingdom is driven by the concentration of skilled workers. All right. Some of it, for sure, is driven by area effects, but not all of it. And nowhere near as big as it would do. The other thing that I do want to bear in mind, and that will bear importantly on the conversations we're going to have about the need to improve cost effectiveness in terms of our policy response, is to talk about the persistence of these disparities. And here's a slightly depressing figure for anyone who is thinking about what the likely pattern of development is over the next 10 years, for example. Okay? So on the bottom axis here, I put average area wages in 1998, and on the y-axis, I put average area wages in 2008, so 10 years later. Your eyes aren't deceiving you, right? This is basically, the line that fits through these is basically a 45-degree line. So think about it. You know, those of you who know your British political history, you know, we had a Labour government which spent far more generously on regional development assistance than the current government is likely to be able to do within its funding envelope. And that more generous spending achieved precisely zero convergence in terms of getting the poorest closer to the richest, okay, in terms of relative wages. Now, I'll put a proviso in here. We don't know. It could be that the situation would have been worse if we hadn't been spending this money, right? But whether or not you want to put it on, you know, the situation could have been worse, for sure we know that spending that amount did not achieve rapid catch-up. So we're going to spend less, so we need to be more effective with the money that we are going to spend moving forward. Being more effective with the money that we're going to spend moving forward means being realistic about the underlying drivers of spatial disparities that I've just been talking about, and also having a much more laser-like focus on the cost-effective policy response. So do we know what works? I think we have a reasonably good understanding of the market forces that are driving uneven development. I do not want to put everything down to market forces. There are certainly things that the British government does that arguably reinforce those disparities. But there are also things they do that try to counteract those disparities. Okay? But for sure, the market forces lead things to be strong and uneven. So that's, you know, one sense in which we do have some stories. Look, I'm not going to pretend that these things are completely uncontested. There will be people in the audience that want to put much more of an emphasis onto public expenditure. But certainly the market forces, notwithstanding this, lead to uneven development nearly everywhere that we observe the market operating. All right? So we do know, we have some understanding of what works. Do we care? I mean, that's a far harder question. I think something that we will pick up, presumably, a lot in the question. The real challenge here is that you have to be realistic on policy effectiveness and the extent to which we can rebalance in the face of those strong market forces. Are politicians realistic? Do they care about this underlying evidence? It's very difficult for them. You know, we have constituency-based politicians. I am not a constituency-based politician. So some of the things that I'm going to say in a moment are very easy for me to say because I do not represent one of those poor constituencies. Okay, I'm very realistic about the constraints that policymakers face. But I will say that there is a long history here of not really learning about the fundamental underlying driving forces. Because incoming governments, and I hate to say it, it is always incoming governments, they fail to recognise the strength of those underlying economic factors and the extent of the challenge. This is not a criticism explicitly of the current government and Theresa May's idea of an economy that works for all. If you go back, David Cameron and Nick Clegg said similar things when they came into office. And if you go back, Gordon Brown, when he took over the premiership, said similar things. And if you go back, Tony Blair said, no place left behind, right? And I could just keep going back, all right? And this is such ancient. Maybe Margaret Thatcher didn't think this, all right? The history of the last 20 years is that every incoming government says it's going to do these things. It doesn't recognise how profound the market forces are. It tries to do a bunch of things, and it really, really struggles in terms of achieving rebalancing. So let me turn now to the specific question of policy effectiveness. What are the policy instruments? And here that we can start to use to tackle some of these things. And here I want to talk about the work that we've been doing at the What Works Centre on policy effectiveness. So the What Works Centre is a collaboration between the London School of Economics, ARUP, represented by Lynn Charing, and the Centre for Cities, Alex is here to represent them, that is tasked with basically trying to understand the impact of policies and to improve policy effectiveness in driving local economic growth. So here is the kind of stuff we do. And look, in a 15 minutes that I've given to this, I can't talk you through all of our activities. So, I strongly encourage those of you who are interested to go and have a look at the website to see all of these activities. Everything we do is open to all. But I'm going to talk a little bit about some aspects of it. So one of the things we do is evidence reviews. We basically say, what do we know about policy effectiveness, the impact of different kinds of policy interventions that we use to try and address those spatial disparities? We then do a couple of other things, which is we work very hard with central and local government to help them understand what that evidence is telling them and to think about how they can embed it into decision-making. And we also work with local and central government to say, all right, well, what are the areas where we need better evidence? We don't really understand what's working, and can we fill those evidence gaps? And I'll lightly touch on all three of those areas as I talk through now what we've done and what we understand in terms of what works. So let me start with the evidence reviews. I'm not going to get overly technical here. We focus on impact evaluations. Okay, and what we mean by an impact evaluation here is that we want to know what changed for the people that were the beneficiaries of the program. That might be a household, it might be a firm, it might be an area. We want to know what changed for them, and we want a comparison to similar firms or workers or areas that weren't beneficiaries of the policy. All right, so that's what we mean by impact evaluation. For those of you who are more technically oriented, propensity score matching or higher. Okay, for those of you who aren't technically orientated, just block your ears and pretend you didn't hear that. Okay. Let me tell you what we do in this slide. So this slide summarises what we've found in our evidence reviews. So we've been busy. We've been running for about 3 years. We have covered access to finance, apprenticeships, broadband, business advice, employment training, estate renewal, innovation, public realms, sports and culture, transport, enterprise and empowerment zones, and European Union structural funds. So we've got through quite a lot. There are four columns on this. Let me take you through them quickly. The first one is how many studies poor old Lynn and her team discover when we first do the word saying impact evaluation in that policy area. 1,450 things claiming to evaluate access to finance studies. The second column, labelled SMS3, is how many of those are actually impact evaluations. There is not a typo here. We are not missing a zero. Okay. Of the 1,450 studies that claim to look at the impact of these schemes, only 27 do a before and after for firms receiving access to finance support and compare it to firms that are not. We can come back to what this tells us, but let's carry on with the sort of substantive story here. In the third column is how many of them look at employment as an outcome, which is a pretty crucial policy objective here. And the fourth column is how many of those are positive. Now, those of you who are quick will see that in only about half of these cases does the impact evaluation suggest that the scheme is having a positive impact against stated policy objectives of increasing employment. Now, look, some people think that when I was given the What Works Centre, we just should have immediately labelled it the Oh My God, Nothing Works Centre. Okay? You know, that is far too pessimistic a viewpoint. All right? We can get policy that is effective. Around 50% of these schemes, you know, have positive effects against stated employment objectives. Now, look, there are some people, I'm afraid, who go the other way, who think that everything works, that the only problem that we've got in this country is that central government and austerity and the mean old Tories aren't giving them enough money. And if only they had enough money back to Labour days, they would be able to spend that money and be incredibly effective in turning around those disparities. Now, we've already seen that that doesn't work at an aggregate level. Even those levels of expenditure that we did have weren't turning these things around. But it also doesn't work at a micro level. You know, if we were, for example, to devolve out to local authorities and say to them, look, why don't you guys go off and choose what employment support schemes you want to do, and 30 local authorities took us up on that offer and went off and run employment support schemes, there is a chance that 15 out of the 30 will not have a positive impact on things that we care about. All right? And this is a pretty, you know, key message for understanding why we have to improve policy effectiveness if we want to get more serious about rebalancing. Now, a few years ago when I was doing this, we only had that evidence. We are now expanding the evidence base. So here are some of the other things that we do. So we actually say, so instead of just looking at overall policy effectiveness, what do we know about the effectiveness of individual components of a policy? So if we take something like employment training, and we were trying to design a program in a struggling area to deliver employment training, what components might we put in there? And we start trying to unbundle that. So the things we've looked at so far, on which there are evidence, are careers counselling, financial incentives, pre-qualifications, reminders. And I don't know whether David's going to pick up on this, but, you know, picking up on the sort of work that BIT have done, you know, the crucial point here is that what we're trying to do is identify interventions that are more cost-effective when we are thinking about applying employment training in a deprived neighbourhood. And so, for example, here you notice, those of you that are quick, that, you know, if you come to the bottom, we have quite good evidence in other contexts, not employment training, but in other contexts, that providing people with reminders about attending something like a gym or a training event or whatever is a very effective way of getting them to actually turn up and is terribly cheap. So one of the things that you know, this flags up to us is that reminders to kids to try to get them to remind them what courses they've got this week, etc., may be a terribly effective way of increasing attendance at college. And we know that increasing attendance at college is positively correlated with going on to graduate from that college. And we know that graduating from the college is positively correlated with improved life chances and better outcomes. Okay. So this is the kind of thing that we are doing in this space. I'm not going to try and summarise all of it. I thought instead I would just give you a feeling for, so, you know, having gone through all of this, do we know what works? And I think, you know, it is fair to say that we know far more than we used to. Like I said, I'm not going to go through all of those different policy areas, but I thought I would give you a sort of flavour of the kind of things that we can say, and I'll refer you to the reports themselves and the toolkits for further details. So we do know stuff on the relative effectiveness of different policies, all right? So let me pick one that upsets people terribly. I am a football fan. I support the glorious Arsenal, all right? I think sports and culture are hugely important, but we often see claims made for sports and culture that suggest that this is also an economic growth lever. Okay, and actually, if you go and look at the evidence, sports and culture is a much less effective local economic growth lever than employment training. If you go and look at things that say, look, does hosting Olympic Games or hosting sporting events or hosting cultural events, can we really detect large local employment impacts from that? Many of the studies that try to detect these employment effects just can't do that. Okay, just can't find them. Whereas we know it does for employment training. So one of the things we can talk about is relative effectiveness of different policies. There are other controversial examples, but one will be enough to upset people, and I can pick on some others when we get to things. We also know about the relative effectiveness for different objectives. So one of the things we often hear is that local areas would love more control over innovation policy. All right? Now, this is all very well, but actually, if you go and look in terms of policy effectiveness, we have pretty good evidence that grants and loans and some of the tax incentives that we're using are good at driving up research and development, measured research and development. They do what the direct impact. We have quite good evidence that they improve innovation in the firms that receive this money. You know, they do use this to invent new products, which might lead to a patent or change processes in the firm. The things that we don't have very good evidence on is that any of this filters through to improve productivity at the firm level or improved employment at the area level. Okay? So, you know, we have big battles over who will have control of these policies, but well, it depends on the objectives that we're trying to achieve. I'm a huge supporter of the government. I come from LSE, so I'm a huge supporter of the government spending large amounts of money on leading-edge research. You know, you're not going to hear me arguing against this. But they do it to drive our, you know, up R&D, to drive up innovation. And we hope that that then spills out across the economy, not stays localised in specific firms. I need another sort of 5 minutes, Lynn. Is that roughly timing all right?
Go on, then.
Yeah. We know stuff about the relative effectiveness for different areas. Again, I've picked something controversial here, but which, you know, people will not be happy to hear. You know, so what do we know about broadband effectiveness? We know that broadband is a much more effective intervention in terms of local economic growth in urban areas than it is in rural, for service firms relative to manufacturing, for high skill relative to low skill. Okay, we know that this is the case. Now, let me make a caveat here. I actually think that there are quite strong public good arguments for providing broadband to rural communities. I think that there are quite strong public good arguments for the state supporting culture and sport. I'm just purely making the case that the evidence suggests that there are not strong economic arguments for doing these things if we are trying to drive local economic growth. The other thing that we do, and we're starting to do more and more of, is to say, all right, well, okay, it's all very well, but the crucial thing that we need to do moving forward is how can we increase effectiveness? And there, you know, we are starting to compile evidence, so I'll give you a couple of examples on this. So, for example, actually, we do know that an in-work component of employment training is positively associated with much better outcome for employment training programs that use it. So we can start to unpick these things. We do know that area-based initiatives, or at least we have reasonable evidence, that area-based initiatives that are selective, that target firms who do not serve the local area, for example, that serve export markets, are likely to generate more net employment than blanket support that cross-subsidises firms and businesses that just serve local markets. All right. In short, we know that area-based initiatives are more effective when they subsidise a machine tool firm serving German export markets, or whatever it's going to be, China from now on, than if we go in and subsidise a hairdresser. All right. So we do know much more than we used to, but not as much as we'd like. Now, you know, a lot of the stuff we do at the What Works Centre, which we might get onto, is saying we do need to think about how to learn from local interventions. And a lot of the work that we're doing is trying to improve the policy cycle of designing pilot schemes, testing how they work, improving them, thinking about how to implement, monitor, evaluate, and going around on this feedback loop. Again, this is something very much that comes from the behavioural insights team and stuff that David has been pushing very strongly in government. So we're doing stuff to learn. Now, do we care? So here I'm going to tread carefully, all right, and I'm going to leave someone else to tread less carefully. You know, look, let's be realistic about the extent of the challenges here, all right? We're talking about the need to better use evidence and better embed evidence and evaluation into policy design. That is difficult. Okay, it's difficult in two senses. It is difficult when it goes against people's strong prior beliefs. A lot of what people want to do in local economic growth is driven by, I'm afraid, a rather poor understanding of what is causing local area problems. there are also major capacity and resource constraints. You know, if you're a local authority faced with needing to meet your legal obligations on social care versus putting in place a monitoring and evaluation framework for your employment training, you see where this is going to balance out. It's also the case that robust evaluation is high risk for politicians. It really is, you know. The British public are awful with this. You know, if politicians say, look, we've got this idea of something that we think might work, so we're going to go and pilot it, and we're then going to really properly try and assess that. And if it doesn't work, we're going to change course. Yeah, okay, good luck with that. Now, that gets even worse if you do that at a local authority. I remember the mayor of Bristol, the previous mayor, here with the red trousers, saying to me, you know, just think of the post. You know, just think of how much we will get killed by the local newspaper if we open ourselves up to the fact that we need to be figuring out what's effective. I mean, the one thing that I will say in terms of do we care what works is that the absolute red herring on this is the hugely strong position people take on whether we should be centralised or localised. I, on balance, I'll put my cards on the table, think that policy effectiveness would be improved with us being slightly less centralised than we are now. But people who argue on the extremes of this are not supported by the evidence in any way. So, what works? Last bullet. Basically, if I had a pound for every time I was asked this question, I could refund the centre with no problems. I'll make two broad points here. I mean, I have a big picture answer to this, which is about realism, about the underlying market forces. If policy is not framed taking into account those underlying market forces, we get ourselves in trouble. So what's the kind of things that come out of that? I'm afraid it is things like investing in infrastructure in areas where investing in infrastructure is really likely to increase productivity and generate jobs. You know, we can't just take infrastructure expenditure, put it in places that are massively struggling where infrastructure is not the problem, low skills are, and expect this somehow to magically turn that place around. Look, some of this we're getting right. I mean, I do actually think if we can sustain Manchester and Leeds at the heart of the Northern Powerhouse, this does fit with that kind of story. What else do we need to do? I know it sounds boring, but we need to make sure people have the skills they need to access these new jobs. All right? And all of the evidence that we have on this is we've got to start early. You know, we need to go early years, early intervention foundation, education endowment foundation, get right back to early years. We know things about, you know, if we want to improve the outcomes of disadvantaged people, can we please stop doing high-tech policies? All right? You know, if you want to improve the outcomes of disadvantaged people, focus your support on those disadvantaged people. Do not rely on trickle-down to somehow magically turn around the lives of the poor. Okay? So we can do these kind of big-picture things, and I'm sure we'll come back to them. What about the detail? I don't know who this person is. It's not me before my January diet. You know, people always sort of somehow expect at the What Works Centre, they ask us, so what works? And it's sort of really like they expect me to give an answer. Like they expect that how good policy making works is that some academic says, here's your recipe for success. 2 cups determination, 3 cups effort. Right, you know. That is not the way good policy making works. All right? I'm not going to stand here and say to you, oh yeah, we know every single area should do this. That's the way that we, you know, get things to work at the local level is to make sure that when local decision makers and central government decision makers are trying to formulate policy, that they are paying attention to the kind of evidence that I have laid out for you this evening. Only by paying attention to the evidence, embedding that in the decision-making process, do we have any chance of improving policy effectiveness around local economic growth. And only by doing that do we have any chance of addressing the fundamental rebalancing problems that confront us.
That was Henry treading carefully. Thank you, Henry. David, it'd be great if you could perhaps respond to Henry's remarks and make some observations of your own.
Thanks. I thought I'd sit down. I hope that's all right. Just to list, first of all, just answer the question. do we know kind of what works and do we care? I think the answer to both of them is not enough, actually, which is pretty straightforward. So I'm going to talk to you just briefly and make some comments around with two hats, actually. So, partly on the behavioural side, but partly also as I serve ministers as national advisor on what works, which is kind of championing the kind of stuff which Henry does, really. So just asking the what works question is a surprisingly radical one to do, actually. The kind of presumption is that, well, people think about that all the time, but they don't think about it very well. So, in fact, just to reflect for a moment on my behavioural world that I live in, one of the interesting questions is why, whether you like it or not, why didn't evolution, you know, people make this difference between system one, system two, thinking fast, thinking slow, those know Danny Kahneman's work. And a really interesting question is, why didn't evolution bestow us, the bit of our brain which is supposed to be good at doing stuff, you know, the thinking slow, seems not very good at thinking in lots of areas, it's prone to errors, but in particular, a way of characterizing it is as a press officer. We carry around in our brains a press officer, which is incredibly good at giving an account of why what we're already doing or what we already think is the right thing. We are brilliant at this, superb rationalizing about what we do. We all are like that, and policymakers too. As opposed to, you might have hoped that evolution would have bestowed on us someone like Henry, who was, you know, a kind of methodologist or a natural scientist who was actually trying to figure out what is true in the world. Well, that isn't, for the most part, what our brains do very well. And in fact, interestingly, the more education you give people, the better they get at generating rational arguments for why they're right, but they don't get any better at developing counterfactuals. So it does seem partly an interesting part of the human condition is we're not very good at figuring out what works, actually. And the first step is to recognize that and try and do something about it. So briefly, when in 2010 David Cameron wanted to create the Behavioural Insights team, so I had done a stint actually in government in Number 10 previously, came back to do that, but we tried to introduce two things. One was a more realistic model of human behavior, that's right, which is kind of cool, funky results. Henry referred to one of them actually. But also, the kind of quietly radical thing was a more empirical approach to doing things. Why wouldn't we just quite often say, when we have to write a note to a minister, actually, we have no idea. Really, we have no idea what works in a situation. As opposed to what you'd normally do is say, yes, minister, we've thought about all the various options. This one would be terrible. This one's, you know, not so good. This one's our recommendation. Great, we'll go with it. Where really, we just don't know. And a more honest system would have that built into its heart. It would just repeatedly be saying, actually, we don't know. But the good news is, I'm a bit more optimistic maybe than Henry, is we could figure it out. Actually, we could deliberately test variations or use natural variations and try and answer some of those questions. And that's an extraordinarily radical thing to introduce into government. And that's really what the What Works centres are all about. And it's not just centres, it's actually a movement is a better way of thinking about it. We are in the process of trying to retrain every single policymaker in the civil service in Britain to understand a series of basic methods. So when Henry would say something like, you know, it's everything above propensity score matching, they would know what that means. They would know what a discontinuity method is in a randomized controlled trial. Why would that matter? It's because you would do policy in a fundamentally different way, right? You wouldn't say, we know the answer. You'd just say, Minister, that's such a great idea. We're going to do five versions of it. It's so good. Why waste it on only one variant? Let's do five. And then we'll find out which of your brilliant ideas is the best of all. It is possible, it seems to me, to run policy in that way. Incidentally, it also means that there are lots of things which we do as evaluations, which we might as well just throw away. They might tell you whether the money was spent, you know, in the area or spent on Ferraris somewhere else, but it doesn't really tell us actually an answer to the question about what works. And I think one of the most shocking tables when you put it up is that number of studies in an area, and that's presumably academic literature, some of it, right? And then a number of them reach even quite a rudimentary methodological threshold, which might tell us something which is true. We've got to do something about that, right? And that's definitely not just to be left to the analytic profession. It's involving doing policy and practice in a different way. So just a kind of few quick points, really. One is, I think we do have some grounds for optimism. I mean, Henry's taking on a particularly difficult puzzle because you've got a lot of complicated things and spillover effects. But if we take the example of education, if you look at how far we've come in the last 5 years, it gives you grounds that it is possible to turn this around. So unlike, say, in healthcare, where you could literally turn and say, there are hundreds of thousands of really quite good quality trials, so when you go and see your doctor, they are able to say, actually, I recommend this pill. They didn't just sort of think, oh, I feel like a blue one today, so how about that? there's actually some evidence base. You've got some grounds to be confident they're making a recommendation might work. Maybe not so much when you move outside of pharmacological practice, but anyway. But when you drop your kids off at school, why do you think that the way that they're being taught maths or skills, indeed, in general, is the most effective way? I mean, education has not been, including HE practice, very evidence-based. And people often thought, oh, of course, but we couldn't run experiments on our children. Well, how else are we going to find out what's more or less effective practice? And it's only 5 years old, Educational Endowment Fund created, one of the What Works centres, has gone from a world where, I mean, maybe once a decade you'd have a kind of really good education intervention which would meet some kind of decent threshold. In the last 5 years, conducted more than 130 large-scale randomised controlled trials in British schools involving more than 500,000 kids in several thousand schools. And you know what? The world didn't end. We actually haven't had parents on Whitehall protesting about your experimenting on our children. And in fact, parents often are like, well, of course, that makes sense. The other thing that it beautifully does, I think, is it often creates this kind of contagion in the system, is that what you gain if you take part in it as a school is, in the same way you see in medicine, is that what it's really doing is making you more sensitive to what constitutes good evidence. So it has these other positive effects. And now more than two-thirds of schools in the UK are routinely using the toolkit produced by Educational Endowment Fund to figure out what they should spend their money on. So it is possible. And if it's okay to experiment on our kids, then why wouldn't we be able to do that in relation to city deals or regional expenditure and so on? Of course, there are methodological difficulties when you're trying to decide, trying to work out the effectiveness of a transport system, but lots of things like, you know, different kinds of bonuses or vouchers you give to businesses or skills-based interventions are amenable to those kind of interventions. And it's really important that we make that argument, actually. And it's true that ministers worry a lot about the Daily Mail, etc. It's really important there are people out there who are making the case for why this is the right way to proceed and do policy. So just to kind of push back a couple of last kind of points, what do I think we need to do more? And I'd love to see, I mean, Henry will know, as I say the same to him privately. I think we need to be much stronger in terms of tempering all of our interventions from the outset with the ability to test, evaluate, and frankly, where we can, RCTs, right? And this should be normal practice. And the Treasury should just say, if we're giving you this money, by the way, we expect you to evaluate it. And by evaluation, we don't mean experimentation in the everyday sense of I'll try it out. We actually mean have a counterfactual and so on. And it's really important that we will go much further on that. I'd actually say one thing is sometimes it gets overstated, which we should nuance my own remark, which is it's not evaluate everything. What I really want to see Henry and the What Works Centre doing in their next phase is sort of strategic evaluation. So what are the areas where we've really got a key gap? Here's some extra money to use in some other ways, I hope. You know, where actually we really don't know what works, but let's try and figure it out. Or where is there a natural experiment to be able to proactively go into an area? It's true Educational Endowment Fund have 120 million endowment, which makes it easier to have that conversation. And the question is, well, why couldn't we do something similar in this area? I'm not promising, but working on it. I do, on the other hand, I think the bit of the quid pro quo is that to translate and answer the question, well, for a given area, what do we think is your best punt about what works where for who? It is difficult, and I always think one of the interesting things with Henry is he always says it's very, very difficult to do this, but if you lock him in a room in number 10 and someone says, really, can you tell me, you're actually pretty good at answering the question. And we have to, even though there are imperfections in it, people will make decisions. So we might as well give it our best shot, not least because we've got on-stream decisions around EU funding and lots of other areas. We should hopefully next week have the industrial strategy out. And we even have a relatively interventionist prime minister who wants to do more in these areas. So I am really sharply aware, and particularly in this area, just conclude, how much we don't know. And it's frankly shocking. It's not good enough, right? We've just got to do something, and we could do something about it. And the only thing I'd say to you, looking around the room, some of you young faces, is it's really interesting and important. These are intellectually interesting questions. We don't necessarily need a load more maths in an American journal to make the world a better place, but it's a really interesting question to try and figure out, not least what some of these marginal changes are that can make a big difference. And maybe since you mentioned it, I'll just give you this one concluding example. There are lots of things that don't work, but we do sometimes find things that work, and it's really so exciting. So Henry made reference to a BIT study, which actually there's more results coming on later, but It basically was in FE colleges. It was a decent size, sort of 10,000 samples, so not bad. I know why we only get one padlock on your rating. We send text. We work out when the dropout rates for young people in FE colleges in particular. And there is a very high dropout rate. And basically what we do is we send them texts around, like, just before the end of half term. A lot of people drop out. You know, you might be finding, we're really looking forward to seeing you on Monday. It's implementation attention. Make sure you plan your way into, you know, or when people drop out, kind of you work out when the time is. You might be finding it hard right now. A lot of people do, but it's really worth persisting, etc. It costs about £2 a person. It's really cheap. It improves the attendance rates for maths and English by about 20%. And it improves the pass rate by 12%. Really cheap, really simple. So it may not always be high speed 2, but to establish those kind of variants, right, in an empirical way, in everything we do, imagine we do it, everything we do to get these sort of small marginal improvements, that is a really radical play. And it's very doable, and it's an interesting intellectual project, which I hope many of you will join in the coming years. Thank you.
Finally, Alex is going to close us off with some observations on Do We Care?
Indeed. I mean, it's disconcerting for me. Running the Centre for Cities, we're all about improving city economies. And actually, many of the things that Henry says are the things that I normally say on platforms like this. So I'm going to talk, as Lynn says, about a bit about the who cares part of the question. I think there are some very big issues when it comes to local economic growth and the who cares question, particularly at the moment. You know, there is a growing body of evidence. We definitely need more. There's a lot of people who are interested in this. What's been striking about the What Works Centre is how well attended our events have been by people across the country coming to hear what the evidence reviews have found, what Henry has to say when you lock him in a room, but also what each other have to say, raising some of the kind of practical policy issues they're facing day to day, sharing the lessons with each other. So there is a market for this. There's an appetite for this. But it's undeniable, I think, that this isn't easy. It's not easy to have some of these very difficult conversations. And in an era where people have had enough of experts, it gets even harder, I think, to make sure you've got the demand for evidence-based policy, not just from officials and ministers, but actually from the wider public, with all the nuances and caveats that go with evidence-based policy, and particularly where that's going to conflict with the political narrative or with kind of very important economic concerns that people have. So I think two things I'd like to highlight to kind of really kickstart the discussion and hear from questions in the audience. I think the first one is about that tension I think we're seeing more and more between some of the politics and some of the economics. So the debate that really was illuminated by the referendum and the result last year, it's really highlighted the concerns people have, quite rightly, about the current economic model, about whether globalisation is working for them. This isn't just about London and the bankers versus the rest. I mean, that's come up. That was a part of the debate, concerns about London. But it's also about Manchester and Liverpool and Bristol versus the rest. So I'm going around the country hearing from people that actually there's some people within Greater Manchester who don't feel that what's good for Manchester is good for Greater Manchester. And that doesn't necessarily chime with the economic evidence that actually there are benefits from this. So I've had conversations with people saying, well, why is Manchester getting all the Grade A city centre offices? Why can't we have it in the outskirts? Why are all the knowledge jobs going to the city centre? Why can't we have some of those? Why can't we spread that? Why can't we make sure that we have the same number of houses being built everywhere in this wider area? Why isn't it the same? Why aren't we getting the same? Why isn't it equally shared? And I think some of the big challenges in that are, well, actually, if you did try and share it out like that, because it's not working now for many of the reasons Henry's highlighted, would that deliver the results people want? I mean, we've tried some of this in the past and not evaluated it very well. We have built big, shiny innovation campuses in the middle of nowhere, and they do okay. But do they do as well as they would have done if they were in places where lots of these skilled people are already living and where there's lots of the businesses that might be able to benefit from that and there's all the spillovers? Not just for the high-value, knowledge-intensive businesses, but actually for the retail businesses and the people selling. You know, there's footfall, there's all kinds of benefits of having campuses in a city centre that are not just about the high-tech businesses. So there's a desire on the part of people to have the same, to see the kind of success that they can see in some of the city centres, in their area, a very understandable desire. But there's a question raised by the evidence about whether trying to do that would A, work, And B, would deliver the results that people want? Would it make the difference people want it to make? Because all the work that what Work Centre does and that we do says probably not. A lot of the financial incentives to move somewhere tend to be temporary for the businesses that are tempted by that. They tend to move at the end. That actually often if you put an innovation campus somewhere, lots of the local people don't benefit that much from that, actually. It tends to be people commuting. So I think there's a big challenge that the government is facing, that the Prime Minister has said she wants to grapple with, about how do you support economic growth? How do you boost productivity as quickly as possible? So we do raise wages, so we do improve living standards. And how do you do that in a way that works with the evidence? Because a lot of the evidence says if you concentrate some of the infrastructure investment, as Henry said, on the areas already that are already successful, that will deliver the fastest, generate the highest levels of growth and taxes for the UK as a whole. So on aggregate, that's the way to do it. But we already know that that's... you can question whether that's exactly the way it's been done in the past, but it's not delivering enough benefit for enough people if you don't deliver some of the policies that help some of the people in the disadvantaged areas, some of the people who don't have enough skills to benefit from that. So you don't... We haven't managed to do that in a way that works for enough people. So you need to deliver an economy that works for more people, but that's also highly productive. How do you bring the economics of this together with the politics of this and explain it in a way that works? And that means that politicians want to hear some of the difficult messages about what the evidence shows will work. So you should be focusing on skills, for example. For many of the people who can't benefit from growth, skills is absolutely critical. It is less easy to cut a ribbon for an employment training course than it is for an innovation campus. It's less easy to point to it and show what you've done. And therefore, it can be harder for politicians to say, this is how we're going to help many of the people in some of the areas where you're not able to access growth. So there's a risk, I think, as political pressure grows, politicians don't like what some of the evidence says is going to work, because it doesn't resonate with the political, with the narrative about we should have the same, we should have exactly the same chances, we should have the buildings, we should be able to see what benefits, you know, how we have benefited from things. And so you end up going for policies the evidence doesn't support and that don't work for many of the people who are most concerned about what happens if Manchester City Centre gets the growth. So you have a tension, I think, between the kind of the politics and the economics that we need to do much more to grapple with. We need to know much more about what will work for some of the areas where it won't be as many high-level, knowledge-intensive businesses, but it will be other things. It will be some, but not loads, of manufacturing jobs. It may be logistics jobs. It may be actually improving access to the city centre. There are different solutions. We need to do more to work out what they are. We also need to be raising the demand for the evidence, for wanting to know what works rather than going with what sounds good, with what our gut instincts tell us would be really good if it could only work. And I think we need to do much more as a centre, as both centres, to raise the demand for that. So that kind of big tension we're seeing with Trump becoming president this year, French and German elections this year, the Brexit negotiations starting. This is a big macro tension that I think plays into some of the stuff that we're doing here. I think the second thing, very briefly, I wanted to highlight is just the tension we also see, and Henry and David both touched on this, between a desire for kind of simple things to follow and actually it's much more complex, nuanced nature of what works in evidence. You know, your point, David, about for ministers, they've got a really good idea and they just want to implement that really good idea and perhaps don't want to hear about the five different ways you could do it, which is more nuanced. People don't necessarily want to hear that if you're like this kind of place, then you might do this, this and this, and you could trial that and it could work and it might not work, but it could. That's not an easy thing to say to the local paper, who will be asking, like the Bristol Post does, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? How does that work? I think one of the strengths of the What Works Centre and the things that have been done has been communicating that these things are nuanced and trying to do so in as accessible a way as possible, and arguing that things like sports and culture are very, very important for lots of reasons, but you shouldn't rely on them to deliver some of the economic growth. They're important for other reasons, and if you want to go for them, you should decide to do so for other reasons, not because they're going to deliver jobs. There's different things you should do for jobs. But I think that tension between communicating things in an accessible way, in a way that actually helps the politicians make the case nationally and locally, and ensuring the nuances there is another tension. So you've got the politics and the economics and how you can bring them together in a way that genuinely works, and the complexity of what works and how we need to experiment to find out what works, and it's going to be risky and things will go wrong and that should be okay. All of that complexity alongside being able to talk simply And by simply, I mean just mean accessibly in a way that doesn't bore people who are talking about this down the pub and who aren't all of you and aren't really interested in this anyway and want to give up your evenings to talk about this. We need to find some way to grapple with that, because I think raising the demand for this at a public level, at a national and local level, helping politicians through this will be really important. And I think by helping them do that, we make sure that by supplying much better evaluation, all the things that Henry and David have talked about, there's also demand for this, and it will get used much more effectively. And I think that will be really important in the months and years ahead.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks to all three of the speakers. We've got about 25 minutes now. I think we've touched on lots of things for discussion. I'm going to open it to the floor for questions. I'd be really grateful if you could let us know both your name and your affiliation, if that's relevant, and wait for the people with the microphone to get to you, not only so all of we can hear you, but so that the recording for the podcast picks that up for those that are listening online. Middle row there in the grey jacket. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Deep. I'm currently working as an economist. Thank you for your talk, all of you. It was really interesting. I've got two slightly related questions. It's for Professor Overman. My first question is, you talked a lot about productivity and you measured it through wages, and you referenced London quite a bit, but I was wondering whether you think the wage that you do get paid in London is actually driven by productivity, but much more it's a causality that goes the other way, the fact that living standards within London are already higher, and whether it's worth factoring that into your research. So when you take, somewhere in Plymouth, et cetera, obviously living standards are significantly lower, and would that affect your results in quite a different way? And secondly, it's quite a radical solution, but I'm not suggesting that this is actually practically possible, but would decentralisation away from London in terms of like politics or et cetera, actually moving the parliament, which has been done in other countries, whether that is a solution that might actually drive skilled people away from London where you've already got finance, politics, et cetera, all concentrated in?
So the living costs driving wages versus wages driving living costs, I mean, this is a source of considerable confusion. But the way that economists think about it is that from the perspective of the worker, you know, the individual worker, it's hard to figure out what the direction of causality might be, right? So is it, you know, are we more productive so we get higher wages, or is it because living costs are higher that we get higher wages? But from the point of view of the firms, it's got to be that being in the high wage place makes them more productive. Why the hell would firms volunteer to pay higher wages if they weren't getting higher productivity? So we certainly, you know, think about the fundamental driver here being from the higher productivity, that's what drives the wages up, and then it's the wages interacting with the supply of housing that drives living costs up. I won't go into the housing supply question. So, you know, we really do think of productivity differences being the fundamental driver. The decentralisation one, I see this a lot. It's a red herring. I think there's just two broad points I'll make about it. I mean, firstly, I think that there is an argument for having less centralised decision-making in Britain, right? So for being more local, we are very highly centralised. I think it's hard to make an evidence-based case for this, but I think that there are lots of reasons why more localism, shifting that way, allowing experimentation, etc., would be a good thing. But moving Parliament doesn't achieve that. You know, moving Parliament doesn't achieve better decision-making at local authority level. It basically disrupts the lives of 20,000 reasonably well-paid civil servants and shifts the seat of government to somewhere else. I have no idea why we'd think this would be an effective tool for driving change. So I'd much rather see you know, I think we've got enough challenges in terms of effective decision making. Now, that's not to say that I don't think that some aspects of, you know, the public service provision can go outside of London, but I just think the idea of moving Parliament per se, it's fun to debate it, but it's pointless. I mean, we want to think about making government effective. I think there is an argument for localisation as a component of that, but there is not an argument for basically uprooting, you know, tens of thousands of civil servants or firing half of them and re-employing another bunch of civil servants somewhere else. I just don't understand this. There you go.
What do you really think?
Well,
does anyone else want to comment on that?
Oh, that's good answers.
Any more questions from the audience? In the back row there in the grey jacket.
Thank you. Angela Francis, economist from Green Alliance. We're an environmental think tank. We're spending quite a lot of time thinking about industrial strategy now from an environmental context, but very much trying to not pick all our sectors, but try and think of the environment as a context in which all businesses are going to have to succeed and deliver high productivity. The challenge we're particularly finding is in relation to lagging areas. And if we were thinking about the places that are vulnerable already or already have an industrial heritage and no industrial future, so the Port Talbots, the kind of Grimsbys, the Bostons and Lancashires of this world, we hope it's a strong argument that to say whatever those places do has to be green, highly resource efficient, otherwise it's never going to succeed in a high cost based environment. But do you see resource efficiency and renewable energy as being part of the solution for local economic challenges, particularly in those lagging places? Or is that a strategy that's on a hiding to nothing for us in terms of our advocacy?
I think that the blanket call for the green economy being the solution for those sort of places is really fantastically simplistic and runs counter to much of the evidence that we have. I mean, we sort of constantly see calls for the fact that it's green tech, you know, which is going to be the solution for these places. Well, you know, green tech, by its very nature, you know, the generation of green tech is a high-skilled activity that does not employ large numbers of lower-skilled workers. And the problem in these places is that they have large number of people who may well be very, you know, proficient at the specific thing they're doing, but whose skills are not transferable to these other kind of activities. So, you know, it's. I think the blanket statements about its effectiveness are not very helpful. I'm willing to see the evidence presented on individual, you know, on an individual basis. But, you know, so far, I'm afraid much of the stuff I see isn't that. You know, I mean, if you basically go around and look at industrial strategies for deprived places, they either say. Well, a lot of them say green technology, so they're all going to do that. Or they say high-end manufacturing, yeah, so they're all going to do that. I mean, these are these sort of statements that we get. They just run counter to, I think, the stuff that I was putting at the beginning. You know, the fundamental challenge here is to generate demand for employment for workers at the lower end of the income distribution, or to move those workers, you know, or to reskill those workers and move those workers up the skill distribution. And, you know, sort of blanket appeals to particular kind of solutions, they could have a part to play in that, but, you know, I struggle to get from some of the broad claims that are made to a detailed understanding of how this really feeds through and changes the lives of individuals in a way that I think would work in those areas. Sorry, to be pessimistic.
I mean, I think
I think that kind of differentiation between whether green energy and kind of some of those industries are going to be part of the solution for those areas, I think I'd agree with Henry. Individually, for some of them, part of it, possibly, but to what extent it kind of can provide all of the jobs, and I know you're not suggesting it provides all the jobs at all, but I think one of the challenges is some of those areas are perhaps in their wider rhetoric, suggesting it is a much bigger part of the solution than in practice it can be. So I know that's not what you're arguing, but I think part of the debate about this should be looking at where the opportunities are in this, as in other sectors, but not overstating what they are in terms of employment. Ideally, of course, the solution for these areas and for all areas, we should be thinking about environmental impacts and thinking about sustainability. To what extent there are jobs in that, or to what extent that should be part of the thinking about what are the strengths of particular areas, what are the characteristics they can build on, starting from where they are and where they could be rather than where they'd like to be, and trying to kind of tick lots of boxes. And I think too often the green technology discussion isn't the nuance that I think you're talking about. It is, can we get loads of jobs in that? That'll be our future. This can be the answer. We should definitely do this. And by the way, we should do life sciences and biotech and a few other the buzzwords as well. So I think for lagging areas, building on the existing strengths, green technology might be one of them, or environmental kind of industries or energy, or might be part of it, but it's got to be part of it. It's got to start from where they are.
Just to springboard off that point, there is a tendency for local places to be quite sectorally focused in their economic strategies. And I think it's fair to say that the evidence that we've pulled up and that Henry presented is not sectorally focused. Why do we think that it is that areas are so keen to go down a sectoral route and picking winners?
I think Alex picked up on it. It's, it was interesting, actually. You know, I have advised places where we go in. I try to avoid naming it and probably end up dropping it in at the end. But, I've advised places where you go in. There is a natural tendency for local areas to think we're really struggling. We know the industries that we used to have that defined this place and made it successful. So what we've got to do as part of the strategy for turning this around is identifying the sectors that are our future. And they basically go and they consult with local firms and they come up with the six accelerator sectors and the five key driver sectors, etc. And, you know, the interesting thing with that is nearly always when you then go in and say, all right, now let's take what your firms are doing in that sector and compare it to, say, the UK average or the 25% best areas or whatever, that often they don't have any advantage in these activities whatsoever. So I think there's a tendency not to use enough analysis in identifying the things, identifying the sectors, not using enough rigorous analysis. I think there also is a terrible tendency to basically look at the kind of industries that successful places have and think that therefore success must mean that we'll get some of those. I mean, biotech is another really good example of this. I mean, every single RDA strategy had biotech in it. The regional development agencies in the 1990s, every single one of them would have had biotech as a crucial sector for the local economy. So I think it's that. And then I think it's something that David, maybe Alex said this, but I just think it's not very glamorous to say, look, you know, we don't really know. But what we've got to be doing is making sure that the advice that we're giving to business, that we're providing that in a cost-effective way that will allow businesses to grow whatever industry they're in. So we're going to work really hard to figure out what kind of advice we give to businesses. Or, look, I don't know where our access to finance should be going, so we are going to have to try and develop a good model on access to finance. Or I don't know what export support works, so I'm going to experiment to try and figure out what kind of support I should be providing to firms. It's much easier if you just cut through all of that nuance and say we're going to target these five sectors and that is our industrial strategy. So I think I think there's an analytical lack that people get there, and then I think there's just a political economy reason why this is a much more interesting thing to do. By the way, I should say, sometimes I think, I mean, the other reason why people tend to do it is just occasionally it works. I do actually think, and I will name this specifically, I think that the BBC moved to Salford. You know, we probably could demonstrate that, you know, probably in the medium to long run, that will have been a pretty positive thing to have done. So I think that, you know, people then take those one sort of, you know, we take that one very visible success. Actually, Manchester's interesting because probably Manchester is one of the places where sports helps as well in terms of driving the local economy. But so we tend to, it's an availability type heuristic, right? I mean, you look around, is that the availability? I never remember which one this is.
It's confirmation bias.
Confirmation bias, right? So, you know, you look around, you see, oh, well, it happened to have worked for Manchester on sports and Manchester on media, so it must be a vital part of the strategy that we put in place in other places. Whereas, you know, when you look at the average effect of these policies, the average effect, actually, it's not a very replicable. But I think that's why we get there.
Thank you. More questions from the floor? Oh, my goodness, suddenly we've got loads. So I'm going to take a few at a time so we can try and get through as many as we can. Gentleman in the front row there, and then I'll take the gentleman back over there.
Going off the comments just made by the panel, and to be honest, this question might be coming from a position of relative ignorance, but I'm curious as to how kind of the UK has come to this position, whether it was kind of centrally designed or whether it was organic in terms of, for example, when we look at America, you have different sort of hubs, different cities which are hubs of different industries. So LA in terms of entertainment and culture, New York in terms of finance, Washington in terms of politics and so on and so forth. How is it that everything's become so centralised in London and to an extent where we can't sort of organically, or was it designed that way, or has it organically developed that way?
Thanks. Can you just tell us your name?
Sorry, my name's Damini.
Thanks. And there was one at the back there, I think. And then after that, there's a lady just there in the grey jumper.
Thank you. My name is Gilles. I'm a student in environmental economics. Coming back to the question of productivity as measured by the wage, is there any link between productivity and inequality in the cities you discussed? And could that be a barrier to local development?
Thank you. And then there was just one in the back row here, and then we'll go to the panel.
Rachel Hesketh, the Policy Institute at King's. I'm interested in knowing how much the panellists think that the outward migration of skilled labour from underdeveloped areas is part of the problem, because it seems it might be a vicious circle at play where there's no jobs, so skilled people leave, and then because they don't live there, industries or firms don't migrate there, and what can we do to break that cycle? Thanks.
Great, thanks. So we've got, how did we get here? How do we become so centralised? Is there a link between productivity and inequality? And is brain drain from from low productivity areas compounding the problem? Who'd like to start?
Sure. I'll pick a couple. So on brain drain, we just published a report looking at the brain drain. It highlighted 6 months after graduation, if you look at the Russell Group graduates with a first or a 2-1, 37% of them came to London. Over half of Oxbridge graduates did. It is a challenge, absolutely, that, as Henry said, if you've got more highly skilled people in a place, it does better. Should you be trying to keep people in a place? Well, I think this should be about having, if places have more of the jobs that people wish to do, then it's much easier to keep those people. So I think there's a part of the challenge is not, you can't stop people from moving to access jobs, and many people are making a choice to move to London because they see that as having the highest concentration of jobs. One thing is about making sure that people are aware of where there are good jobs. Another thing is making sure you really invest in education at lower levels. So at schools, further education, making sure you're investing in skills and all the way through, so actually in existing jobs, training people in there. So I think there's a supply and demand challenge. Of course that's an issue, but actually making sure there's the demand, there's the jobs there for people to access, making sure there's the infrastructure to make sure you can live in particular areas and still access high-level jobs will be really important. The other one I wanted to respond to is centralisation. Has that kind of been by design or developed? It's kind of developed by design to some degree, I think, in this country, so actually we weren't as centralised. Joseph Chamberlain, all the examples that you know, it got more and more centralised. Over the last kind of 50, 60 years, it's got more and more centralised. Margaret Thatcher didn't trust some of the local authorities. Some of the local authorities didn't behave in a way that encouraged trust. And so things got more and more centralised. And there is an idea that if you pull levers in Whitehall, there's things attached. I think we would argue that there isn't all the time, and there hasn't been a good enough debate about what should be done at central level, what should be done at local level. There is evidence that certainly for the functional economic area, if you take more decisions about transport and planning, and they're more effective done at the functional economic area, certainly not in Whitehall, where my favourite example of where centralisation, I think, is failing is not just that we have one of the most kind of the biggest postcode lotteries going, so the argument against centralisation is often there'll be more of that, but also that Whitehall, somebody in Whitehall got wrong once and didn't realise there are two Newcastles in this country. There is a very big Newcastle upon Tyne, many of you will have heard of. There's also a very small Newcastle under Lyme that got some of the money intended for Newcastle upon Tyne because somebody hadn't realised that there were two and they spent it very quickly. So Newcastle upon Tyne to get it. But, so I think it's developed over time and then it becomes inherent in the system and it gets quite hard to change. So it's quite a big thing to change it, and it's good to see some of that with the mayors now.
Do the last one?
Yeah, with migration.
Productivity and inequality.
Well, actually, I'll link it to the outward migration thing as well. I mean, we just get terribly muddled with this. I mean, I hinted at it. I don't understand what spreading the high-skilled workers around the country is supposed to achieve. I mean, at some sort of token level, it achieves more equality, right? Like, you know, area averages look more similar. But why do we care, right? I mean, you know, imagine a world in which all we do is shuffle around some high-skilled workers, but no one's wages change at all. What have we done? You know, I mean, we've basically got area averages looking more equal, but, you know, no one is better off. I mean, in fact, if anything, we'd expect we'd probably be worse off. I mean, that's the sort of that's the sort of technical answer, and this is why I'm saying there's a sort of the productivity inequality stuff. I mean, you just have to be really think hard about where the inequality is coming from. My favourite example of why I get so worried about arguments around spreading out skilled workers or about the focus on productivity being, you know, not necessarily a good one, etc., is Barking and Dagenham. You know, we've basically got a city, you know, we've basically got an area which is like 20 minutes commute from, you know, an area which has a huge high concentration of skilled workers, offers huge opportunities, etc., but has appalling levels of deprivation. Now, you know, Barking and Dagenham are, you know, doing some really interesting things to try and tackle this, but it is quite clear that the solution to their problem is not having large numbers of high-skilled workers sitting nearby. So, you know, any of these sort of solutions that suggest that the solution for the poor is having more people like me living near them, you know, nice as I'm sure that would be for them if I, you know, we move the LSE to Manchester. You know, I struggle to get the sort of mechanisms that then, you know, why do we... Let me put it another way. Barking and Dagenham is a really good example. I don't understand why we think that trickle down is a concept which has failed at national level, but somehow we think that trickle down is the solution to all of our local problems. So I do think we get a terribly muddle. We get a terrible muddle when we're thinking about what works in that sort of macro sense of not really fit about getting confused with aggregations, about getting confused with composition, etc. If you don't like that way of answering it, I'd just come back to the fact that any solution which suggests that what we need to do is to make Manchester look more like London, I do not understand how that will tackle the problems of Oldham, because it has not tackled the problems of Barking and Dagenham.
Are we doing one? Or are we closing?
I was going to take one more very quick round. Do you want to come in on that?
No, because I just want to make a more general comment at the end. But go on, you do it.
Okay, go on then. So I'm going to take a quick round of comments, questions, and ask the panel to come back very quickly on that, because I'm conscious of time. Right, lady here in the stripy top, gentleman just there in blue jacket, and someone right at the back on the back row there.
Okay, so you touched upon education. I was wondering what your thoughts are on the importance of disparities in education levels, in the quality of education. across the country in deepening those income disparities. So should it really be at the heart of this debate, or should more consideration be given to elementary level education, which would, my feeling is that it would allow to create kind of knowledge. Well, we are moving towards a knowledge-intensive economy. Would it allow us to create knowledge clusters outside of large metropolitan areas? So that's one, and linked to that.
Can we just have one, please? Sorry, because we haven't got.
That's actually, it's very similar. So basically, obviously, it's difficult to assess. Education impact is difficult to assess in the long term, but its impact it really impacts the longer term. So in your analysis, have you looked at long term impact of all these policies, or did you focus on the short term?
Okay, thanks. Gentleman here in the blue jacket, and then finally the gentleman in the back with the beard.
Great. My name is Zi Cheng. I work at APT. It's very interesting for me because what we do at APT is to actually apply evidence-based decision-making in the private sector. I know, David, you've partnered with Jim, our founder, as well. And I think it's been interesting because we've talked a lot today about actually questions around what works and what doesn't, rather than actually what we perhaps should also be talking about, which is how to get all of that evidence, which you already have, into action. So my question is around, given all the challenges that we've been hearing about, are there examples over the last few years or even now where we've made some recommendations as a part of the World Work Center for Local Economic Growth to the government, and that has then been actioned? And it'd be great to hear, some of the experiences there. And if not, then it'd be great to hear, what would be some of the upcoming things that would be most likely to lead to that.
Okay, thank you. One more, and then we'll go to the panel.
Hi, I'm Jay, and I work with some citizen-led economic development initiatives in the Southwest. I come from Totnes, as you can tell from my accent, probably. And this is the town that saw off Costa Coffee a few years ago. And we made some arguments around the difference between non-local ownership of companies and local ownership, and the extractive nature of non-local companies coming into the local economy and disrupting the local supply chains that already existed. We made arguments about the local multiplier. And anyway, it seems like the issue of ownership is important, and I was wondering if you could comment on it.
Great, thank you. So we've got the importance of early years education and breaking the cycle of disparities. Any evidence that the government's picking up on anything we're suggesting? And something around whether local ownership does a better job of embedding wealth.
I will just answer the first one. On education, is it important? Yes. I mean, all the evidence suggests investing in early years, investing in kind of primary school, investing in secondary school, investing in better education has big benefits, and that's true across the country. So I think it's a very important thing, particularly for some of the more disadvantaged people. As Henry was saying, if you want to help some more disadvantaged people, education and skills training will be one of the key ways to do that.
So you're next, and let David finish. Look, non-local versus local, look, fine if you don't want Costa Coffee. Fine if you want to spend more locally. You'll be screwed if everyone does it as a policy. I mean, it's the isolationist type policy. I mean, we had an area when we did everything locally. It was called the Dark Ages. I mean, a more serious point here is that, I do think ownership, et cetera, matters. But, we just get sucked into broad debates around those kind of things. I mean, what I think one of the... I did that glibly. But, if we have every local authority starting doing public procurement to support its own local firms, and we have people buying local, you know, especially on non-traded services. We are basically just extracting demand from other communities, and when they retaliate and do exactly the same thing, we are, you know, taking demand from our firms that would have come from those local areas. I really think that that sort of excessively local focus is on a hiding to nothing. I have, by the way, you know, but no problem with communities deciding they you know, they don't want posture and they don't want to support it. I mean, the market economist in me thinks that don't shop there if you don't want it, rather than impose that ban on the rest of them. But, you know, that's a personal preference, not an evidence-based one. But I'm allowed one in the whole evening. Let me finish on a couple of things which are more positive, because, you know, David often rightly corrects me for being a little bit pessimistic. I do actually think that the message that there are elements of social and economic policy around education, around improving mental health outcomes, around supporting people with drugs and addiction, around trying to do things for disadvantaged families, around getting in and improving educational outcomes for kids. I do think that the message that we can do better in those areas, and that doing better in those areas is crucial for actually trying to improve the lives of the disadvantaged, is a message that is slowly getting through. And, you know, I mean, it's interesting. One of the pilots that we're working on, which with BIT and have been advising some of the work there, is on, you know, better lining up mental health support with employment training support to try and stop people's mental health problems from being exacerbated by attempts to get them back into work and leading to them to fall out of the active labour market support. So actually, I do think across a range of things, the sort of initiative driven by David and others is demonstrating that we can improve cost effectiveness around key things that I actually do think are major challenges in terms of turning around local economic growth. So actually I am, to some extent, an optimist that, you know, we have got more focus than I have historically seen on figuring out what's effective, and on the fact that economic development policy is broader than just industries and infrastructure, and that, you know, there are things that we need to do that go right the way across the What Works network that will be vitally important in turning around local economic growth. And I think, you know, we were asked about getting evidence into action. You know, I think we are. We are seeing local authorities starting to be interested in piloting these things. So that employment training and mental health pilot is a good example. You know, there are three local authorities who are out there trialling innovative ways of joining up mental health and active labour market support. There are local authorities in London who are trialling more effective ways of dealing with people who come off of the work programme without having secured employment. There are local authorities across the country currently trying to design employment pilots that will allow us to look at more effective employment support. So there is a side of me that is that thinks that we are... there are lots of positive signs out there. I mean, there is, though, the major challenge that Alex confessed. I've never known it to be so two-edged. I think in private, when I deal with civil servants and local authorities and central government and local government, I feel that the idea that we need to focus on what works and evidence is possibly got the strongest body of support that it has had in the 20 years I've been working in it, actually. But the public rhetoric is the exact opposite of that. And there really is this sort of double-edged thing going on that, you know, throughout the country, in central government and local government, people really, really are trying to engage with this. But the political rhetoric is pulling them away from that. You know, one of the major challenges moving forward will be how we balance those two.
Right.
David, can I ask you to close?
Concluding comment, yeah, sure. So I partly wanted to See, Henry in his remarks earlier laid down what sounded like a really difficult challenge. We're spending probably less than many previous administrations, although it's ambitious, maybe we could do more, but and yet why would we have any, you know, ground for optimism at all? Well, I think actually the word is kind of medieval. I mean, the level of knowledge, as you saw in your kind of your tables you put up, in many areas is so weak, we shouldn't be surprised you didn't get much returns, because we were really stumbling around with that. We're throwing money at things with some very vague, odd theories, some of them produced in a place like this, without much grounds for that. But why I think I feel positive is that when you scrape beneath the surface and you do try and be a kind of empirical, but there's lots of grounds to think there are many areas, whether it works at local or national level, I think actually could be both or whatever. Well, if we could figure out a bit better, we'd make huge strides in relation to skills and education, particularly, for example, in the soft, so-called non-cognitive skills, massive issues there where we could do a lot more to move the dial, we think. We haven't historically. Specific issues like depression, mental health. I mean, depression is the single greatest cause of any condition of years of working life lost. There's loads more you could do in relation to improving outcomes, which the PM made some comments on last week. In relation to productivity in firms, and the UK's low productivity, why do we think that, you know, it gets to a firm in, you know, widget producer in Wigan about what's the best way of running a firm in terms of the design of incentives? Do they read Harvard Business Review on a regular basis? No. What are the mechanisms? They're very imperfect that spread understanding and knowledge. Profound failures in relation to B2B markets. Even worse there than you see in consumer markets. How can a firm tell the difference between good and bad? Will McKinsey give me a return? Will they not? There's not easy ways to solve those kind of issues, or even one around social trust. I mean, social trust. If you can boost social trust in a local area or a national area, it has huge impacts. It's good grounds to think, well, what can you do about it? So I do feel like it is quite plausible, let me say to you, to introduce this stronger empiricism at macro and micro level, and particularly this kind of, you know, testing and learning experimentation, and to think, as was true in other areas, like in crime and so on, it is possible to move the dial with that kind of knowledge. So I hope we'll try in the coming years, and hope we'll see some of that even in the industrial strategy very soon. Thank you.
Thank you.